Hey, Calabris. It's Ben Leroy.
And I'm Jason Buckholz.
Welcome
how you doing,
to Calabricast, talking over each other. How you doing, Jay?
It's like episode 10. Someday we'll figure out how to take turns. I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm doing all right. Now, most people would probably be inclined, because it was just at the start, to go back and fix that. But I think that this
we're
is
just
going to
keep talking over each other.
Yeah, just going to keep talking over each other. And I think this is important, because what we are trying to talk about today is the importance of editing and developmental editing. And to show you what it looks like when something is not in its perfect form, I'm just going to go ahead and leave that all in there.
Sounds good. Just leave it in. Yeah, so there are many types of editing. There's a lot of confusion about what all those are. And to add to the confusion, these terms are not used interchangeably across the industry, and there are multiple terms for various things. But today we're focusing on what we call developmental editing, what is also called content editing, which is really the first stage of editing once you've got a complete or very nearly complete manuscript.
And that experience that we're drawing on is, for those of you who aren't familiar, I've had about 20 years of either being a publisher or an acquiring editor in the publishing industry. So I've worked with a lot of authors to help doing the developmental editing.
As have I, and not from the publishing side, but from a editor for hire standpoint, to help authors prepare their manuscripts to then try to share with somebody like Ben in a position at a publishing house or with an agent. And as you all know, it's a very, very competitive industry. There are not a whole lot of book deals out there. So putting your best foot forward is always very important.
Essential.
And there are artistic visions. There are all sorts of things that people want to do, but then there are also industry realities and best practices. And every author's job is to figure out how to balance those things, how their vision can work in that greater context, assuming that what they want is a traditional publishing contract, a traditional book deal.
There's also, in addition to the technical side of things, we acknowledge that because this is something that authors have spent a lot of time, presumably, putting together, thinking about, obsessing over, eschewing other entertainment options, hanging out with the club. We understand that this is a process that can be laden with a lot of emotional resonance, and that there is an effort that should be made to separate emotion from the work, while acknowledging that that is easier said than done, and that sometimes feedback and editorial notes can feel like a personal attack when it's not. It's in betterment and in service to the manuscript, but that is sometimes hard to compartmentalize. And so we acknowledge that. And if it is something that, when you are working on your book and you get feedback and you feel attacked, that is a common feeling. And hopefully you are in an environment and you are getting feedback from somebody who is not levying a personal attack, but is indeed interested in the betterment of the manuscript.
Yeah, it can be overwhelming. So we want to explore that. We want to explore what that is like to receive that kind of information, and then what the different mind states that you can go into that process with. First, though, let's define what a developmental edit actually is. So this would be a full and complete and careful read through of a manuscript, and then a very long and detailed letter. So at the with the developmental edit phase, this isn't a lot of people who are new to editing or the process of being edited think back to their elementary school teachers with the red pens or whatever, marking up their manuscripts, there versus there versus there, that kind of stuff. That's all line editing. That's later on in the process. The process of developmental editing is much more the big picture stuff. So it's more of a conversation about the manuscript, about the ideas, about the overall structure, and what that actually looks like for somebody who purchases a developmental edit is a long and detailed letter about that manuscript. That in this letter would point out all the strengths, everything you're doing well, and then obviously also opportunities that your editor thinks you might have missed, suggestions, things that aren't working. And that could be an entire character arc. It could be a major central premise of your story. And it's one thing if someone says, yeah, I don't really feel like this character should be wearing a yellow dress in this scene. That's an easy fix. But when somebody says, like, I don't really buy this relationship between these two people, or in my own personal case, I'm working to finalize a novel manuscript now, and I got some feedback from a reader some time ago now, and it was, you know, there's too many viewpoint characters. It's multiple third person, and it's like it's too diluted. There are too many viewpoint characters. So I made the decision to go back and scrub out a couple of viewpoint characters. But that was not an easy decision because that's a major revision. It affects almost every section of the novel. There are plot points that I have to figure out how to incorporate elsewhere. And like Ben said, it can be very overwhelming after you've worked on something for many years and sacrificed all kinds of other things and put so much of yourself into this thing to suddenly be told, yeah, it doesn't really work. And so how do you react? How do you react when you get that kind of feedback? What are your options?
Before I even get into that, and I'm not going to be nearly as articulate as I might have been 10 years ago when I was speaking at writing conferences on a regular basis and I kind of had a routine going. But I know that my old business partner, Allison, who was with me at Bleak House and at Tyrus, we would talk about how an editor's job is kind of like a contractor who comes in and like the building code inspector who comes in to like make sure that the foundation is level and that the plumbing works and that the electricity works, like all of these things that are essential to the book working, that they actually work. And that the editor's job is to go in and evaluate all of those things and point out where like that looks like it might spark and that might be a fire risk. And that the author's job is that of the actual person who's going to go in and do the labor of the electrician and the plumber, et cetera. Like this is, you're given the punch list of things that need to be taken care of and looked at. And that goes all the way from the blueprints to the paint on the wall. And that's an important thing to understand, is that in most cases, an editor is not best used if you want them to just come in and make the changes and just say, here's what you need to do. An editor is raising questions. An editor is saying, this doesn't work for me because of this. How could you fix that? And the editor is available for the conversation to be had as far as, well, here are some thoughts about how you might fix it. And as Jason and I talked about last week, there's a wonderful feeling when you're having a conversation about somebody's work and you see the aha moment happen where they're like, nope, all of your ideas as an editor don't work for me, but our conversation sparked the idea that will work for me and how I can fix this. And that conversation is a big part of it. And the editor's ability to articulate not only that something doesn't work, but why it doesn't work, and then being part of a conversation to get to potential solutions is a really critical thing. Because when people find out that a book doesn't work in its current form, for me, in my experience, I have seen a couple of different responses. Some people who will insist that no, it does work, and that they will continue forward with it as it is, and they don't want to hear feedback. They don't want to be told that it doesn't work. Although, as we've talked about before, there are plenty of times where, as an author, you are aware of something not feeling like it works exactly right. And you may try to skate by on the hope that your reader isn't going to notice the thing that you know doesn't work. So some people try to get by on that. And then when it gets called out, they have that realization of, okay, I do know that. I did know that. And then they might try to address it. And other people, again, might just dig their heels in and say, well, the two of us saw that, but nobody else will. And, you know, that's not really a realistic thing. You will, you know, run into people who will try really hard once they've painted themselves into a corner to figure out some magical way of resolving the issue that is not consistent with the book that has been laid out up until that point. So they will, you know, this is the hand of God thing where this totally improbable solution that was not at all set up in the book will amazingly spring to the forefront, and then that's how things get fixed, which isn't really satisfying to the reader and can often end with people getting the urge to throw a book across the room. And then, you know, this has been repeated so many times by me over the years, and then I know that other people have also repeated it, that it feels to me like the most truthful thing. And it also is how I react to certain things. So there's probably some bias confirmation going on where I think, yes, well, that's clearly the best way of handling this. And it may not actually be for everybody. But the author Harry Cruz, there was a documentary being done about him. And he talks about that he had been working on a novel, and he got to a point where he knew that something about it was fundamentally flawed, and so fundamentally flawed that it couldn't really be fixed. And so he talks about how when people are confronted with that realization, that they may go back and try to duct tape and super glue things together and cut and paste large chunks of it to make it work some other way. Or you throw the whole book in the fire and start again with what you've already learned and assume that whatever knowledge you've gotten from working on the book, the first draft will apply itself to the second draft and you won't make the same mistakes again, or you won't write yourself into the same corner. And that's really hard to tell people to do. It's like, okay, well, you've got 100,000 words here and a lot of it's good, but you're going to have to throw the whole thing away. That's really hard. And for me, I've gotten to a point where I can do that. I may even be too quick to do it. I may just say, okay, this isn't perfect, therefore I'm going to quit looking for a solution to solve it, and I'm going to throw this away. I, as I've talked about before, I'm now 10 years into working on the same novel. And if I could show people what the first draft looks like versus what it looks like now, it is a radically different book. And probably 5 or 6 years ago, in an earlier draft, somebody read it and they said to me something like, this is a great self-contained small novel. And I had this realization where I was like, wait a minute, I never set out to write this great self-contained small novel. Like, I'm a sprawling mess writer. Like, I like to be able to just pull on all kinds of threads. And I thought, okay, well, clearly, if this is someone's response, even if it's praiseworthy, even if it's saying, hey, this book's ready to go, the book that that person was describing to me is not the book that I intended to write. So I had to start over. And I've figured out ways to make it bigger and sprawlier. And I'm not using sprawling in a bad way. It's a, this is the story I meant to tell, and I didn't tell it the first way. And can I copy and paste all these scenes? Maybe. But if I'm going to make it bigger and sprawling, then that's going to change my understanding of the characters, of the place, of the events. And so using old material isn't going to be consistent with what the actual story being told is. So the ability to throw the whole thing in the fire is an important part of the equation.
You talked about a certain, I think that the ability to detach yourself in a certain way from your work is really important. Kill Your Darlings is a famous, almost so famous that it's become kind of a cliche in editing circles. I had read an interview with Bjork once, and she was talking about songwriting. And when she found that she was having trouble with a song, it was just not, wasn't able to finish it, that she would go back and she would take out her favorite part of the song. And it was always by getting rid of that thing that she was most attached to, suddenly it created all these other opportunities for her. But it's hard to do that. I thought that her, that interview with her was such a succinct way of doing it. It's like, well, you have to go take out your favorite thing, because that's always the problem. Again, much easier said than done. For when I'm revising, and I've in the current draft that I've done, I talked about this current revision where I'm taking out viewpoint characters. I've taken out probably 15,000 words so far, and I'm about halfway through the manuscript. What I do is that I have a separate document open. So I'll have the document that I'm working on, and then I have a separate document, and then I have two sections of that separate. So I entitle that other document The Cutting Room Floor, borrowing from film editing. And everything that I'm pulling out of my manuscript, I'll put into that document. So I'm not just deleting it, even though it's sitting in old drafts. I feel better if I have like this other place to put it. And then in that document itself, I have that divided into like the recycle and the landfill section of that document. And some of this stuff is just, I'm pulling it out and it's just gone. And other things are like, it is those things that I know are good, like an inspired passage or an observation or a metaphor or whatever it was that I don't want to put in the landfill. So I park it in this other document. I get it out of the manuscript where it was causing problems, but then I put it in this other place and maybe I'll come back to it later. It's there. Like maybe I'll resurrect these characters in some other way later on. So they kind of go from being, I kind of return them to this well of raw materials. It's like, okay, you're not working in this story. Like, you know, I did all this work. We did all this polishing. It didn't really amount to what I thought it was going to amount to. So I'm going to, if you're sculpting and it's like a chunk of clay, it's like, okay, this arm isn't working. I'm gonna take this arm. I'm just going to mold it back into a big lump of clay and then put it on the shelf. And maybe I'll use that for something else at some point. But the main thing is that it it gets it out of there and clears up that space for other things.
I really like the idea of the recycle and the landfill. I think that you should figure out how that works best for you and do a whole episode about that, or write a blog post that our fellow collaborators can read that goes over that.
I could do that. I could also do just like an experimental spoken word performance that's all just rejected. The outtake reel, the recycle bin outtake reel, found art. But for me, it makes it less painful to take out some of these things. And like you said, you work hard on things for years and you sacrifice other, you know, nights out or other things that you could be doing so that you can, you know, sit there at your screen by yourself and try to put this thing together. And in order to be able to do that, in order to make those sacrifices and do that work, we have to somewhere along the lines convince ourselves that what we're doing is of real merit, that this is, you know, a contribution that we are making to whatever discussion, to, you know, the body of cultural literature that we're collectively putting out. And so, you know, you do that and you make these sacrifices, then somebody comes along and says, yeah, but, you know, no, it's not really doing what you intended it to do. And I think that's the thing to keep an eye on when you get this feedback. It's like, well, what were my intentions? Because, you know, any given editor is a single subjective perspective, a single subjective mind. You can hire 10 different professional experienced editors, and there's going to be a lot of overlap, but you're also going to have different takes on things. And some people are going to miss things. Some people are going to catch things. Some people are going to be able to very clearly discern what your intentions are, and other editors are going to mistake those intentions and completely misread things. So even as you are working to detach your ego from the work and working to have an open mind to all the feedback that's coming in, it's also important to remember your own intentions for the work. This is one of the things that was so hard about coming out of one of the pitfalls, I think, of an MFA program, is that you go in and you spend a couple of years getting such an incredible volume of intensive feedback from people who you respect a great deal and admire, but you can't absorb it all. You can't take it all in and incorporate it all. So you, at some point, you have to really develop a filter and learn how to recognize when you're getting feedback that is really in line with what you're looking to do. And when you're getting feedback that, like we used a phrase earlier, it's valid, but it's just maybe not for you. Maybe it doesn't work in terms of bettering that particular project. But I know for me, it took me, I finished my MFA program and I had to give it myself a good year to let all the information sink in and filter out and absorb the things that I needed to absorb, and to kind of consolidate or integrate all of those, the voices and the feedback into something that said, okay, I now know what I was meant to get out of that experience, and I can do something with it now.
That's also a really critical thing too, is learning to write and work on the book for the sake of doing the work, and being able to appreciate the growth you have as a writer, as an artist, as a storyteller, and understand that there is a separation between critical and commercial success and what you have in personal development along the way. And that if you measure things only in how much money you make from your writing, you're likely setting yourself up to be disappointed. But if you understand that you've gotten insights into yourself, into humanity, into any particular story by working on it and understanding the value in that, that's really important. That comes into play too, where I don't know what your experience has been like, but I'm pretty sure that I can guess. You have people who are working on their first novel, who have never written a novel before, and get to the end and they're done with their novel and they want feedback. And it turns out that the whole thing probably is a condemned building. And the emotional response in that moment is to think that you have wasted your time. You have wasted your energy. You have wasted your hopes and dreams, because this thing that you've poured all of that into ultimately is not really going to see the light of day. And I would encourage you, writers, that you understand that it wasn't a waste, that you should have learned a lot about storytelling. You should have learned a lot about the basics. You should have learned about character development, plotting, pacing, narrative arcs, all of that stuff that you can apply to a different book. Or, as I mentioned before, you can throw the whole draft that you just completed into the fire and start over. And I by no means am suggesting that you can't duct tape and super glue something good together if that's the direction you want to go. I would just say that
duct tape
people believe
amazing.
People believe that to be the easier option, and it might not be. And, you know, easier for what? To have it completed that you can share with somebody else, or easier to convey what it is that you were trying to say? Like, those are all questions that all come up.
You've got a novel or multiple novels that won't see the light of day that you've written that are in a proverbial, the digital drawer.
The first novel I wrote, I was 18 or 19. I don't even know where that is right now. Then I wrote another novel when I was 20, 21, and I do have a printed copy of that. And though there are some gems, for the most part, it's not really there. Interestingly enough, last week, before Jason and I recorded the podcast, we were talking about how Jason had recently seen Jawbreaker and Jawbox in Berkeley. And
at the Fillmore.
At the Fillmore.
Fillmore, San Francisco.
Yep.
It's great to be back in that building.
And the one of the secondary characters of the novel that I wrote when I was 20, so back in 1996, the last name was Schwarzenbach, and it was a direct steal from Blake Schwarzenbach from Jawbreaker. Like, that's all I was listening to was Jawbreaker. And so I was like, oh, well, one of the characters is going to have this totally unwieldy name that nobody actually wants to have in this novel. But I mean, if I look back, and I could definitely share screen caps of my computer. If I look back, I probably have a dozen novels that are written to completion that have not seen the light of day.
A dozen?
Yeah.
Man.
And it was funny to me. I don't know if you and I talked about this, but you mentioned that you've got your novel, and then you've got another document that has the recycle or the landfill. A few months ago, I got a new computer and I needed to transfer files. And I know that I create a lot of files where I like write out a scene. It'll be a scene that is not ready to be put into the book, but a scene that I know belongs in the book at some point. So I don't have the connective tissue to like, this scene goes here. It's just like, I know this scene is going to be written later. And I have drafts that are 200 plus pages long, but that I ultimately decided weren't right. They took a wrong turn somewhere. And I have character sketches, and I have things that I write out. And I knew that I had a bunch of duplicates of these files because I like save them with a different name, save them again. And I have just files and files and files and folders full of these files. And so when I finally got rid of all of the duplicates and I put everything into like one folder of like, here are all of the supporting documents. Some of these are a page long. Some of them are 200 pages long. For the novel that I'm working on right now, I had at that time 670 separate documents from the actual manuscript that I was working on. And in my book, there's some world building going on, and there's heady concepts that I haven't fully grasped, and that there is no existing material from which to draw. Like, I'm creating it whole cloth. So I have documents that are 5 pages long of me furiously, madly scribbling down these observations and these deep thoughts I'm having about what's going on that would make no sense to anybody else. And I'll be lucky if they make sense when I go back to try to insert them into the novel. But all of that is material that at least at one point I was like, this is urgent and this needs to be documented. And either this or something based on this will go into the novel.
600 plus files. That makes me feel a little panicky.
Oh, it makes me feel panicky too. And what's, like, one of the things that I, you know, do is that I dig through those files and I find that Bjork thing that she took out. And I'm like, oh, but that's really good. I should figure out a way to make that work. And in January of this year, I did the totally arbitrary but necessary looking at the new year as an opportunity to get a fresh start. So I started the novel over on January 3rd, based on a lot of work that I'd been doing in the second half of 2021. And since January 3rd, I've written over 75,000 words new, just straight up, just writing, 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 writing. And I don't have the obligation of fitting in things that existed in earlier draft. I'm not cutting and pasting. I'm not doing any of that. The trick or the fear that I have now, though, is what am I forgetting is not in this draft that was in earlier drafts that was important or that I liked or that I want to make sure is in there. So I'm not even going back to read what I've written since January 3rd. Until I'm completely done with it. And that has been a problem with me. And it's a problem that I know a lot of authors have. You like polish the hell out of your first chapter and you just keep looking at that first chapter and you think, I'm going to set down this very solid base and then I'm going to go forward from there. But I need to sit here and polish this and polish this and polish this. And so it stops you from having any forward momentum. And I had to not do that this time through. Do you do that? Do you get stuck on a first chapter or an early part of the book?
I tend to do a lot of planning and outlining ahead of time so that a lot of my momentum is in place with an overall vision. So I don't, I tend not to get stalled out by getting bogged down in a particular chapter. I don't find that I have the problem of that stealing my focus from what comes next. I don't write a whole lot of extra. Like I'm not one of the writers who just like spits a whole bunch of stuff out and then reduces it and pares it down. I write pretty carefully, sentence by sentence once I'm underway, but I can get bogged down in certain chapters when I'm really, it isn't so much the polishing, it's more of the problem solving. It's like, I'm trying to keep things in mind. Like you said, as you go through subsequent drafts, I'm trying to keep in mind all the threads. I'm like, okay, this character, like his particular approach in this scene has to be informed by all these other things. And I'm just trying to keep that in mind, or, you know, what are the things that he's thinking of? Where exactly in the timeline are we? What does he know? What does he not know? You know, what is his reaction to this? And it's, you have the whole story in your mind, but then when you're writing a particular character, you're not at the later parts of that story yet. And so you kind of have to hold these various realities in your mind at once. And those are the things that I find I get hung up on. And when I go back, once I'm through with this revision and I go back and reread it, it's going to have to be with, you know, it's kind of a continuity issue. It's just kind of making sure that everything makes sense for where it is. And that can be hard to do when you're several drafts in and your understanding of the story as its creator is so different than the understanding that any of your characters might have at any one time. It's keeping all those things in mind, keeping in mind where they need to go and where they actually are.
And that's where having an editor can help with that, because as a writer, you're so close to the material that you forget and you need an outside reader. And it's also where, as we talked about last week, as an editor, I'm not always the best in that particular thing of being able to like hold the continuity stuff, because the way I read is much more emotion based. Like what is the emotional frequency that I'm riding here, where other people are more like, what is the continuity?
I when I do developmental editing, I really like to go in knowing very little about the characters, about the story, about what the author wants. Sometimes I'll work with a client and then they have very specific questions that they have concerns about. And it's important to be able to understand those ahead of time and address those. But beyond that, I want to have as authentic a reading experience as I can. And by authentic, I mean, once that book is out in the world, the information that you get about it, it might be a brief recommendation from a friend or the back cover copy. It's not going to be a whole lot of information. You're not going to be able to talk to the author as a reader and have the author say, well, this is what I was going for, and this is what I'm hoping that this does, and this is really, you know, the underlying conception. You don't get any of those things as a reader. You get a brief recommendation, and then you're off and running. And so it really is kind of this empty, not empty, but it's, you come to it with very little background information. And so it's the words on the page as in order, as you come across them, that really build that world. And as an editor, I want to have as close of an experience as I can have to what the average reader's experience would be.
I don't know that in the interest of talking about this for too long, maybe we've hit the end of this topic for today.
I think we can wrap it up there.
Okay. Well, I would encourage people, if they want to have a discussion about any of the actual collaborators doing developmental editorial work, to go to our website, find the people who you think would be a good fit. If you enjoy this podcast, please remember to rate and review wherever you get your podcasts. Find us on all of the social media. And we'll be back next week.
I would like to just reemphasize the importance of having a separate set of eyes on your work. You know, absolutely. We briefly touched upon, especially when you get into later drafts, how close you are to the work, how much stuff you have cluttering up your mind. You might think that you had things in your draft that you actually took out a few drafts ago and you forgot they were missing, or something that you put in that you forgot you put in. And having a separate set of eyes, having somebody come to that manuscript with all the developmental editing that I've done, I've never had an experience where there was something in that feedback that didn't really create some sparks for the author, where they didn't, in every case, there has been at least a couple of moments where some new possibility appeared to them, where some new understanding of what they had done or what they could possibly do has shown up. And I've had the same experience on the other side of the table with having people read my own work. And it's hard and it's scary to do. It's like you said, it's something that you work very hard on for a long time. You put there's a lot of your ego wrapped up in it, even as hard as you may try to detach yourself. But in every case, it's there. Once you get through that initial kind of overwhelm at that list of things, you mentioned that punch list of things, like, okay, here are all of these things. You sift through those, and there are always a couple of gems in there where you think, oh, this might be a lot of work, but if I follow this thread, this is going to be a much better story. This is going to be a much better manuscript.
Absolutely.
And I truly believe that the only real way to find those is by having somebody good, by inviting somebody else into the process.
Absolutely.
Community. All right. Talking about community.
We talk about story. Collaborate. All right, that was terrible, but it'll work.